This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Stephen Dant. Today is May 18th, 2005. It's 8:36 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, and Steve, you're in Colorado Springs. Steve, we were just talking for a second there before we began the interview again about an incident that you did talk about in your last session when you all had to unload your weapons when the, was it a colonel who came?
I think it was a lieutenant colonel.
Okay.
I think. Don't hold me to that, but
okay.
I think so.
Tell me a little bit more about that incident. You said you wanted to talk about it.
Well, I just kind of as a follow-up, and it occurred to me after our last conversation that, you know, that the time that I was in the field, what occurred to me was that with the exception of that one incident where the I think it was a brigade commander, but I'm not, again, don't hold me to that, I'm not sure. The entire time that I was in the field, there was never anybody on the ground with our troops that were higher ranked than captain. So, and the captains were usually our company commanders, and then the lieutenants were platoon leaders.
Right.
But for the most part, in the Vietnam War, at least where I was, and I don't know about other wars, but the guys on the ground were officer corps, were captain and below.
Right. What does that say to you? I mean, about that you really didn't see any other officers except this one incident besides the captain.
Well, as I said, you know, and we talked about previously that, you know, the higher brass was obviously somewhat afraid of getting shot by their own men because we had to unload weapons on that one time when we came to the ground.
And there was
resentment, you know, when we would know that the brigade commanders or battalion commanders or whatever commanders would be flying overhead in their helicopters, and there were times when we knew that we were, you know, getting orders to move a certain direction because maybe they had seen something or whatever up there. So, we were the grunts, you know, on the ground having to do all the hard work, and these guys were, at least from our perspective, we're just kind of sitting up there in their nice, comfortable helicopters, and got to go back at night to a hooch, and they just weren't participating in the action.
What did that do to you guys? I mean, did you think that was legit, that you had to unload the weapons? Do you think someone would have actually taken a shot at the guy?
I was surprised we had to unload the weapons. It wouldn't occur to me to take a shot at the guy, but when I was told that, I was really surprised.
Yeah.
And I wasn't happy. Nobody was happy about having to unload weapons and out in the.
Sure.
We were out in some pretty heavy terrain, and it was out in a jungle somewhere. In my mind, maybe the brass knew something we didn't know, but I didn't think it was wise to be unloading weapons in the middle of the field.
Right. Did you all ever talk about taking a shot at the command chopper above you or anything like that? Did you ever hear talk like that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, so I want to say rumor or what people have reported or what I have heard, actually, and has been documented in history books, this thing about morale starting to really decline, 69, 70, 71. I mean, would you say that this is evidence of that, that this is maybe part of that tide of declining morale of American troops on the ground in Vietnam?
Well, if not the troops on the ground, certainly the officer corps.
That's a good point, Steve.
If they're worried about getting shot by their own men, then their morale can't be too high.
Yeah, that's a very good point. well,
you know, morale, it, you know, I don't know how morale can ever be very high in a combat unit. I mean, just because of what you're up against. I mean, it's just a matter of keeping it above ground, I guess.
Right. I mean, you're in a difficult circumstance, a very stressful.
Right. With a lot of high stress and people, you know, have gotten hurt or potential of getting hurt or killed. And morale is a relative thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me, when you got back in the rear, and we've talked about this a bit, but I want to know what your specific duties as a driver was. I mean, tell me, did you have to report to a Jeep at a certain time? Were you on standby, hanging out in an office?
I had a report to the office. I had a Jeep to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
I was responsible for the low end maintenance on the Jeep. Taking care to see if the oil was changed and I didn't do the tune-ups, but I helped with that. But I just had to make sure that it was in good working order.
Mm-hmm.
I reported every morning for duty at Brigade Headquarters,
mm-hmm.
at the 198th Brigade Headquarters in Chulai. And then my duties really varied throughout the day. I mean, I would run a lot of errands, that included, picking up some kind of supplies, as simple as picking up some kind of supplies, some PX or something, or,
mm-hmm.
I might be running some documents, from brigade headquarters over to battalion headquarters. I might be driving somebody from the officer corps there at brigade headquarters, someplace around the base, and every once in a while, not very often, maybe off the base, where we would go down to I don't remember what the fire bases that were still open. I want to say Gator or Bayonet or one of those. I might work with the some of the RTOs and then back in the communications center off and on, maybe taking some radio calls from out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But that's usually when somebody was going on break or something. So it was, it was cake duty. I was proud to be a REMF. We talked about earlier what did the guys say when I was, they found out I got my rear job and they instantaneously, everybody, that in the company was calling me a REMF, and I was, my report to them was, yeah, I'm proud to be one,
Yes. Yeah. So when you say low-end maintenance of the Jeep, tell me what that means.
Changing the oil, rotating tires.
You personally had to do this?
Yeah, I remember doing that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If the Jeep needed a tune-up or something wrong with the transmission, then I took it over to the motor pool, since I had to have a vehicle, I'd swap one out and
mm-hmm.
take one back until they had mine fixed. I remember the number on my Jeep. It was number 37.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Just the low-end maintenance. I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a huge difference from being out on patrol in the bush.
Sure. I mean, this is... In my mind, number one, it's not nearly the physical work of humping a rucksack around out in 95 degree heat with 95% humidity.
Mm-hmm.
It was sleeping in a bed every night. It was showers, you know, every day, hot meals every day. I was in a clean uniform with shined boots, and it was closest to being back to the world as you could be while still being in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Did you know the date you would leave Vietnam?
Originally I'd gotten there in February, so I think I got there February 9th or February 8th or something like that. So I figured I was scheduled to leave in early February of 1971.
Right.
But when I got my orders, and you get them a few months in advance, to go back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to come back to Fort Hood, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
It's that time you got to make a decision as to whether you're going to go back to the States and finish your active duty back in the States for the 5 months that you got left.
Mm-hmm.
Or there is an option, if you want, to extend your tour duty in Vietnam for an extra couple months, because if you came back to the States with less than 5 months of active duty, they released you from the remainder of your active duty, and you could sign out of the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to, since I had this great rear job, decided to extend my tour an extra couple of months.
Right.
And so instead of leaving in February, I left in April.
Okay. And you stay back.
It turns out that had I not extended, that they turned a lot of guys loose so they could be home for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and I probably would have been home for Christmas.
Really?
Yeah.
But you, of course, didn't know that at the time.
I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
And had I known that, I probably wouldn't have extended my tour.
Yeah. Well, before we talk about coming home and everything that happened after Vietnam, let me ask you just a couple of other general questions about Vietnam. First of all, Steve, what is there else to say about your duty in the rear? You've talked about where you lived. You've talked about your duties. And I want to ask you about R&R, and I want to ask you about some other things. But
okay.
Are there any incidents, anything that comes to mind when you today picture your duty, that last part of your tour in Vietnam in the rear? What do you see? What's in your mind's eye? Do you see Jeep number 37?
I see Jeep number 37. I see driving all over Chu Lai. You know, I see parties in my hooch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with and sometimes with the guys coming back from Charlie Company.
Mm-hmm.
When they'd be on stand down. You know, I see myself hanging out on the beach.
Yeah.
You know, on you had, I think we had one day off a week, I think, or a half, I've forgotten. But that would usually mean you head down for the beach. And South China Beach is a beautiful
mm-hmm.
White sand, nice place to just kind of hang out and
mm-hmm.
drink a beer and read a book or something.
Mm-hmm.
And counting the days, you know, everybody had a short timer calendar going, you know, how many days have you got left?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's 30 days and a wake up, 25 days and a wake up, you know, 14 days and a wake up.
Did you have a short timer?
The time just absolutely crawled.
Did you have a short-timer's calendar?
Oh, yeah. I think everybody did. I mean, you're marking off the days.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just a calendar that you're putting X's through it.
Yeah.
How much time do I have to go?
Yeah.
Can I get back to the world? Where they can't shoot you and eat you.
Is that what you would say?
Yeah, that was one of the phrases that was around. You know, just put up with this shit and get back to the States, you know.
Yeah.
I used to say that a lot in the field. Don't mean nothing and, you know, get out of here, you know, get back to the States. They can't shoot you and eat you. Which, you know, we're hanging out with some of the, when you saw some of the tribes out west, you wondered if they would shoot you and eat you, you know.
Yeah. Tell me about that phrase, don't mean a thing, or don't mean nothing.
Don't mean nothing. It was, God, you heard that all the time. Somebody got hurt, it was a way of, or somebody got killed, or somebody got a Dear John letter, or, you know, it was just a way of everybody trying to say, you know, you're alive, and we're going to get through this, and... It was a way to try to tell somebody to, a whole mixed bag of things, but look at the big picture, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
This don't mean nothing.
Of course, that was a lie, right?
Yeah, somewhat. But it's you had to. It, particularly in the field, I mean, you had to get things behind you quickly. You didn't have a lot of time to be thinking about things or letting them really get to you for too long, because you had to have your act together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, you know, it was a way of also commiserating with whoever, whatever was going wrong with the guy you were talking to or whatever.
Right. Steve, tell me, in the rear, did you have pets? Did you personally, or did you see this?
God. I guess there were some dogs around, but I never had a pet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only thing I saw around my hooch was a bunch of lizards. You know, nobody wanted them for pets.
Yeah, the geckos, you mean?
Yeah, well, I don't know what kind they were. You know, they were about a foot long,
mm-hmm.
Ugly-looking creatures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I guess lizards and rats, that was about it.
Tell me about the rats.
Well, the rats were weren't as bad at, or in the, can you have one second?
Yes, definitely.
Which is, and I...
Hold on, Steve.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead. Repeat that, please.
I said that the rats were worse, as I remember, in the stand-down areas,
mm-hmm.
when you came out of the field.
How so?
Well, it just seemed like there were more of them, and I don't know if that's because they didn't keep this place as clean or humans weren't around all the time, because sometimes a stand-down area would be, you know, all the troops would be in the field, so it wouldn't be being used. But, you know, I just remember waking up a couple times when we were back on stand-down and hearing... You know, rats scratching around, moving around under the cots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hated those fucking bastards. You know,
well,
you know, you turn on the lights and you get them all out of there, and
mm-hmm.
It just give you the willies.
Yeah.
But I don't remember them really being a problem in my hooch when I had a rear job.
Mm-hmm.
But these suckers were big. I mean...
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, they're, you know, as big as a small cat, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not like the little, you know, 3 or 4 inch variety. I mean, these guys would... hell, they'd probably take on one of my house cats here.
Okay. What about... I didn't really talk to you about this too much, about your life in the field and in the rear, but could you make some comments about the wild animals you saw in Vietnam?
You know, the scariest thing the scariest things I ever saw was one time I came through a hedgerow. I was walking point, and I think I was walking point. I don't remember. Anyway, I came through this hedgerow, and standing in front of me about, 30, 40 yards away is a water buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and he is not happy. And
why is he not happy?
Well, I never saw a water buffalo that liked GIs, like American troops. You know, these little kids, these little Vietnamese kids who go out in the middle of the rice paddy with a stick and beat the ever-loving crap out of this thing, and they just go wherever this little kid wanted them to go. But if you came out into the rice paddy, I mean, that water buffalo was looking at you like, I mean, he was coming after you. And this thing was looking at me like he's going to charge, and I'm going, oh shit, I don't have enough ammunition on me to take this thing down. And,
mm-hmm.
and the word always was, if one of these things charged at you, don't even try to shoot it in the head or the gut. Take its legs out. put your weapon on automatic fire and try to wipe out its legs. Because you're not going to stop it with an M16. So I thought, sure, that this thing was going to come charging at me, and I just slowly backed through the hedgerow and
mm-hmm.
told whoever was behind me, said, we're going to go around.
Why did the water buffalo have a problem with Americans? Was it that you guys were – you smelled differently?
Well, yeah, I think we smelled differently, you know. My dad grew up on a farm. We had a family farm in southern Indiana, and
mm-hmm.
I would kind of be the city kid coming down there every once in a while, and the farm kids always got along better with the animals than the city kids did. I think there's just something that animals sense about you, and I'm sure we smelled a whole lot different than the Vietnamese villagers, and so you know this animal saw us as a threat, and acted that way.
Right. I've heard this before quite a few times.
Yeah.
You know, and I've joked from time to time with veterans that the water buffalo must have been communist, you know, because they really didn't like the Americans.
They did not.
The other
incident I ran in with animals, and we had, when we first moved out of the Batangan Peninsula, and we went west out into the jungle,
uh-huh.
and the first night we were out, and I kind of forgot about this, was, and we'd set up a perimeter, and in the morning, you know, just before dawn, we hear all this rustling in the trees,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, we thought that the NVA was on its way,
right?
And so we opened fire. I mean, we just tore into this line of trees,
mm-hmm.
and next thing you know, you hear somebody yelling, "Ceasefire! Ceasefire!" And it turns out it's a whole bunch of monkeys up in the trees,
mm-hmm.
making all this rustling noise, waking up in the morning. And we ended up, I don't know how many, I don't actually think we shot any monkeys because we were shooting down towards the ground and they were all up in the trees,
mm-hmm.
but scared the hell out of us. Because the first time that we had been in the jungle as opposed to down on the plain in the rice paddies, and we just didn't realize. And so after that, we got used to every morning that these monkeys were going to be overhead and doing their morning thing.
Okay. Did you ever run into rock apes?
No.
Okay. Just wanted to ask. I've heard quite a few stories about the rock apes.
What are rock apes?
monkeys or apes that were quite good at sneaking up on American troops and just kind of you know, families of them living out in the bush, mainly in the Central Highlands area.
No, the monkeys we ran into were the smaller variety.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they probably stood maybe a foot and a half, 2 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's the same one, but I never had any sneak up into our perimeter or try to take any of our stuff or something. It kind of stayed up in the trees.
Right. What about snakes?
A lot of snakes. One of the things about if you were humping out in the bush, particularly up in the hills, and you know sometimes the easiest way to get from one point to another was to be in a stream. And, you know, the stream would maybe, you know, wouldn't be that deep, or, you know, you walk the edge of the stream, but it provided a natural trail, whereas otherwise you'd have to, and you could pretty much know it was pretty difficult to mine a stream,
mm-hmm.
whereas walking on a trail, you know, particularly if you're out in the jungle someplace, you know it's, you know, there aren't many trails out there, so it's probably mined. So I remember a few times, you know, humping along a stream and just seeing a lot of snakes that I just, you know, would go swimming by you, or would be, or they'd see you coming and they'd head a different direction. But
mm-hmm.
I remember particularly these, I don't know what they were called, but some kind of green snake that looked. Well, just scared the shit out of everybody.
Yeah.
You know, we did see one of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I never had one crawl up to me when I was in a foxhole or anything. You know, I got bit by a lot of different bugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had this game going out in the field where we'd have a bug of the day.
Really?
Because every day, I mean, literally every day, you would find some kind of insect or bug or rodent or something different than what you had never seen before.
Every day?
Every day. I'd have something different crawling on me every single day.
And how would you guys play the game?
I guess you'd, I don't know, something, you know, somebody would have the first bug of the day or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Would you come up with a name for it, or were you just...
No, it's just, I mean, it's another way to stay sane.
Right. Well, on that subject, tell me about how humor played a role for you over there.
Well, I guess, you know, I never really thought about it. I mean, I guess you had to have one, or I don't think you'd make it, but there were a lot of practical jokes played. You know, everybody knew kind of where the line was with regard to practical jokes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm trying to think of one and I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of horsing around. You know, I remember my platoon leader, Lieutenant Franco, somehow got a football out into the field.
Oh, really?
So we had a little touch football game going out in the middle of, you know, nowhere. You know,
mm-hmm.
like three guys really throwing the ball around. But
mm-hmm.
I mean, just something that would break the tension and take a little bit of the edge off. And he was good at you know, I was fortunate to have him as my first platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was good at that kind of stuff. He knew when it was time to be serious, and he knew when it was time to get when we go back on stand down that it was, you know, time to party.
Right.
You know, and I don't think he minded if guys, when they went back, were smoking a little pot in the rear while they're drinking their beer, but he wouldn't see of it, you know. He
mm-hmm.
wouldn't put up with that shit out in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've already said that.
Did I answer your question, or did I kind of meander around there?
No, you did a little bit of both, probably. but I get the gist of it, that humor played a huge role for you guys. You just needed it to cope on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Is there any incidents come to mind?
Any what?
Any incidents come to mind, humorous incidents?
Oh, I don't know. We were always, during the day, sometimes, you'd be out at night on patrols, and during the day, I guess one of the ways that relieved tension, there was a lot of card games being played. I played a lot of poker out in the field, most of it was nickel and dime games, which, mm-hmm. Added up to a couple bucks here or there. If you had a pot with probably 10 bucks in it, it was probably a big pot. I think that there were some guys that played for higher stakes than that, but, mm-hmm. I think that that helped take the edge off as well,
mm-hmm.
Pass the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Steve, what about, to change the subject here, what about running into or exposure to Defoliant, and, of course, specifically Agent Orange? Anything that you know of?
I only ran into an area once where we were out on patrol, and it may have been, I don't know, platoon or company strength, and I do remember I was pretty sure I was walking point that day, and all of a sudden I came into this area where it's I thought it had it smelled like CS gas.
Mm-hmm.
And it would appear to be all over, just kind of by that. I mean, seemed like it was covering leaves and branches and kind of stuff. I remember the word going back to the LT with the said, we've run into something here that maybe we don't know what it is, but this place has been gassed or CS here or Agent Orange or something,
mm-hmm.
but we don't want to go in here. And so he called back to the rear, and they turned us around and we headed someplace else.
Okay.
So I only had one instance, and I don't know what we were walking into, but I thought it smelled like CS, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I didn't want to walk in there.
Yeah. Tell me about what you think about the whole Agent Orange thing in Vietnam. And you don't have to comment on that, obviously, if you don't want to, but I'm curious as to what you think.
I didn't have a lot of, at the time, have a lot of thought about it one way or the other. I just thought it was something else we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I... I guess I still don't, one way or the other. If you're asking me if I think it was wrong, I don't think so. If you ask me if I think it was right, I don't know. when you're at war, I mean, you just. You have to use the weapons that will hopefully help you win the war. And we're fighting a war in the midst of a jungle,
mm-hmm.
and the Viet Cong were hiding, and the NVA were hiding in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
So, take away that asset.
What do you think about all the claims and the stuff going on now? By veterans saying that they were exposed and it's caused this disease and this disease and this problem. Do you have any opinion on that or any experience with that?
I don't, because if I was exposed to it, it was just that one time. I don't know of anybody that has made those kind of claims. And I wouldn't, I wouldn't judge anybody on, what their experiences were in Vietnam, because there were a whole lot of guys that had much worse or much more traumatic experiences than I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I consider myself lucky. I think I got off easy.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had a relatively easy tour of duty compared to a lot of other guys I've talked to.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship with the guys in the unit. You know, when you describe a little bit of this when you went back to the rear for duty there, how would you describe it in general, the bond you all have?
Well, I didn't have, the bond was really tight when you were in the field and while I was still in Vietnam, but one of the things about the Vietnam War is, you didn't go over as a unit, you didn't come back as a unit.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, looking back on it now, I think it was stupid. It didn't forge that community, that relationship before you went over there, which I think would have been important. And
mm-hmm.
I think we're doing that today now. Units go over as units.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's the way it was in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about Korea. But on the flip side, when you got out, you ended up losing contact with the guys that you had been so close to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you individually had to decompress from the experience of Vietnam as opposed to going through it with as a group of people. You follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, I think we all learned a lot from that as a country.
Mm-hmm.
At least I hope we did.
Mm-hmm.
That I think that's not doing it that way doesn't contribute to a good morale situation either.
How so?
Well, again, I think if you go over there as a unit, you're building that team atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
That fosters higher morale than you go over there and you're thrown in with a bunch of people and they're all kind of looking at you like, well, we'll give this guy a month. So you make it through the month, then you're part of the deal,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go over as a group, I guess there's always going to be some of that, we wonder if this guy's going to make it, but I don't think it would be to the same degree.
Yeah. How would you all treat the new arrivals?
The FNGs?
Mm-hmm, the FNGs.
I thought that I was always treated pretty well. I think I told you this. I was lucky I had a sergeant kind of took me under his wing and really helped me through the first few weeks that I was out
mm-hmm,
there. And
mm-hmm.
And I think most guys were that way, with the exception of if you really did get somebody who came out to the field that obviously was either as dumb as a rock, and we did have a couple of those guys come out to the field, or had a real attitude problem, you usually try to find a way to, if they were dumb as a rock, you try to get them out of the field, get them back and get them a rear job.
How do you do that?
You tell the sergeant, you tell the lieutenant, who tell the top sergeant, back in the rear. And then, and I think the top sergeant then, most of the top sergeants had been in combat. They knew, you know, and if they had somebody that was, you know, just so stupid that they were going to get people hurt, that you had to get them out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I assumed that the top sergeant would find a way, some job back in the rear where this guy could go and spend his tour in Vietnam burning shit, you know,
mm-hmm.
or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you this, and I don't mean this to sound like a dumb question, but how do you, and no pun intended, how do you tell when someone's dumb? When they get to the field, how do you tell they're not, well, dumb, as you said? They're dumb as a rock, as you said.
Well, I think that you can. I think that most people know when, you know, it's not just in Vietnam, but it's anywhere. I don't think it takes very long for people to size people up that. To determine that somebody doesn't have, and it's not their fault, a very high IQ.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here. You know, that they're just, you know, where they have been through the training and they can do the rudimentary parts of the job, and this is not a sophisticated job being a grunt. but... You know, they're slow to the take.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's how long does it take you to set up that goddamn claymore? You know,
mm-hmm.
they know how to do it, but they're just slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how else to define it. You know, it's just there's no way that they belonged in the field.
Mm-hmm. And so you can just basically tell the sergeant, you know.
Say, come on, you know, look at this guy. And you can't, you know, you yell at him a few times, but you realize, yeah, that's not going to get anywhere. And so
yeah.
Everybody realizes what, you know, you got a problem here and we got to deal with it.
Right.
And I don't think that's even, I mean, a lot of this just goes unsaid. I mean, after it, everybody figures out that, nah, this guy's going to get himself hurt or... He ain't going to cut it.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a problem. And when you're talking about the safety of the unit, you've got to take action in your own hands to do this.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you ever see any homosexuality in the field or in Vietnam in the rear or anything?
Not in the field. I don't remember any in the rear. You know, I'm... No, I guess not.
Okay. Well, could you tell me about your R&R experience, what you remember of it? You said you went to Bangkok.
Yeah, I went to Bangkok, Thailand.
Uh-huh.
Me and the... actually, it turned out I was working with brigade headquarters at the time, but I ended up going, hooking up with a guy who was from my old company, who was the company clerk at Charlie Company.
Mm-hmm.
And... Bangkok was just a party town for GIs on R&R. I mean, it was Sin City. It was a wonderful place for a young unmarried GI, you know.
Yeah.
And it was cheap. I've forgotten what my hotel room cost for a week, but it was. It was cheap. I had a. You went in and you. When you got there, you got the lecture from the. Before they turned you loose, you got the lecture about VD and all the sexual diseases that you could catch by. You know, screwing these whores without any condom on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you had to listen to that for 20 minutes and keep looking at your watch. Can I get the hell out of here so I can go party?
Mm-hmm.
And then they turn you loose on the street. Somehow, you know, everybody finds out that you go hire a driver.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it cost me more than $10 a day, if that much, to hire this guy who would drive me anywhere I wanted to go at whatever time of the day I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice guy. We got to know each other pretty well by the end of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out where the bathhouses are, and you go pick up a nice, cute, good-looking Thai girl, and you spend a few days with her.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the first couple of days, I mean, I really don't remember very much the whole time.
Yeah.
And then the last couple of days, you know, you start saying, well, I'm in Bangkok. I guess I should go do a little sightseeing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And along with all this partying, so we went over to the big temple and all the gold Buddhas and by the palace and just did the normal tourista stuff. And I ended up hanging out with a couple nights with my driver, and he took me over to his pad, and we partied over there for a while with a bunch of Thai guys drinking Thai beer and smoking some kind of weird pot that I'm sure was laced with opium.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was back to the States, or back to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Where I think I had a couple more months to do, and then I was gone.
Yeah. Have you ever been back to Bangkok?
No, I haven't.
Would you like to go?
Sure. I'd love to go back and see the palace, and I'd like to go back and see, I think, the big temple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure I'd hang out in the same bars with my wife that I hung out with the last time I was there.
Yes.
But the, you know, I think that the, you know, looking back, I think the Thai Bangkok government did a good job of taking the GI's money and showing them a good time. And
mm-hmm.
you know, I understood that all of the, you know, the prostitutes and all of the bathhouses had to go to like weekly checks or something.
Mm-hmm.
To see if they had contracted any kind of VD or something, and so they worked hard at keeping the just get away from it in a week in really what was I thought was a beautiful city.
Yeah. Have you talked to your wife about all this stuff, about Vietnam, about Bangkok, about? You know?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know, she knows almost, I think I've told her over 30 years just about everything that we've discussed here.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's much that she doesn't I don't think there's anything that she hasn't learned along the way.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of, you know, it comes out some. It seems like over 30 years, it came out in spurts, and a lot of it didn't come out at all at first.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like that time I told you that, you know, I found myself crawling under the bed, you know, mm-hmm. and I was joking about it. But it really, that kind of stuff, kind of more than anything else, scared the hell out of her when she first saw it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to USO shows? See anything like that?
No.
Okay.
Most of the USO shows that I was aware of, I was making sure that Da Nang was secure.
Yeah. Okay. Steve, could you make some comments about fear and what you saw, witnessed, felt, anything?
About what?
Fear.
Fear?
Yes.
Well, I guess I don't know how to answer that, other than you were always afraid.
Were you?
Sure.
Did you talk about it with the other guys, or just kind of leave that alone?
It was a given. Just, you know, it's if. You know, the only difference I saw about how people were fearful, and I think I talked about this earlier, was there was there were, you know, the guys that dealt with fear that basically said, well, if it's time for me to go, it's time for me to go. You know, that's what the good Lord willed or, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I, you know, never bought into that. I, you know, I like to believe that that what I did and what we all did mattered,
mm-hmm.
and we were in control of our, or as much as we could be, in somewhat in control of our own destinies if we had our shit together.
Mm-hmm.
But that all relates to, I mean, fear. I mean, if you're not afraid, there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. When were you most afraid? When would it happen the most? Do you remember?
Well, I was really afraid that water buffalo was going to charge. I really was.
Yeah.
There were a couple times when I was, one time when we were coming in on a, we were going into a landing zone, and I think, you know, we're a bunch of helicopters, so we must have been company strength,
mm-hmm.
and we're landing in this big open field, high grasses, and we must have been taking incoming. You know, you can never hear if you're taking incoming or not because the helicopters are so damn loud.
Right.
So, you know, but I, for some reason, either door gunner or pilot or co-pilot was anxious to get us off the helicopter because I think that they thought we were taking incoming. And so, if you're on a helicopter, I mean, those things are big targets.
Mm-hmm.
And much as you really don't want to get off and would prefer to keep flying,
yeah.
You know, you really want to get off and get away from that Huey as quickly as you can because it is such a target.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, the helicopter pilot, for whatever reason, I mean, we're still like 3 or 4 feet off the ground, and I you know, it turned out, I mean, I don't think he wanted to sit down because he thought it was wet, and it turned out he was right.
Mm-hmm.
So we jump off the helicopter,
mm-hmm.
and I drop down about 3 feet, and I find that I've sunk up to my knees, or a little above my knees, in mud. So now I have a 65-pound rucksack on me,
mm-hmm.
and I'm up to my knees and my hips in mud, and I can't move. And as far as I know, we're taking fire.
Mm-hmm.
So you get pretty scared if you're stuck in the mud and there's a helicopter hovering above you, and you think that there's incoming, and you can't move.
Mm-hmm.
That was a scary moment.
What happened? How'd you get out of it?
Oh, you just, you know, I ended up slipping off my rucksack, getting unstuck from the mud. I was able to walk at that point, or, you know, well, you've been, you know, in mud.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it's like to try to drag your feet out of that, try to walk. It's, you know. And I slowly made my way up to the wood line with everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know if, you know, to this day if we were taking fire or not, but, you know. I guess he thought we were, and
mm-hmm.
somebody else thought that they were, and, you know, it's just, you know, little things like that, you know, doesn't seem like a big thing, but at the time it seemed like a big thing.
Yeah, I can imagine. Could you make some comments about bravery? What did you see?
Well, I told you I saw it. You know, I know that you know, Jerry got a Silver Star when they were he got shot in the stomach, and
mm-hmm.
you know, after his first helicopter, first dust off went down, the second one, we got him back on that, and he's still firing his weapon after he's shot in the stomach over in the hillside. He probably didn't have to do that. You know, I just... you know, there's... everybody was... You know, there's just a certain amount of bravery that goes with... in my mind, all the guys that were there, the fact that they were there says something about them. And although we all didn't have a choice, but the fact that you know that every single one of those guys that were grunts in Vietnam, one way or another, you know, said, "I'm going to allow." Myself to be put in harm's way, and you know, so I just look at a whole generation of guys that I thought were very brave.
Do you remember?
If you're asking me if I ever saw anybody charge up a hill against a machine gun, no.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, do you remember any incidents, anything that comes to mind? And if it's that, fine. If it's not, you know, what did you see? Or did you not see some extraordinary heroic moment?
The most heroic moment I ever saw really was when Jerry's wounded and man, he's still firing.
Yeah.
But most, you know, most of, that's why I say, you know, I consider myself lucky because most of the combat and action that I saw, you know, was not nearly as fierce as, you know, some of the other things that I hear guys tell me about.
Is that something that you hear talked about at reunions and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, guys talk about where they were and what they did. And do you remember this? And it, you know, some guys remember it a little differently than you do. You try to fit the pieces together. So yeah, there's a lot of those kind of conversations, and you're trying to validate what you did. I think I'm, you know, like most people, we spend a lot of years trying to forget this stuff, and then something comes back, and then you're trying to remember it, and it's sometimes tough to remember everything that happened, or it's a little fuzzy.
Right. Tell me, Steve, one last question about in-country. Did you ever take part in any kind of civic action, any serious interaction with the civilians? The Vietnamese civilians.
Well, we were in a lot of villages when I was, you know, we would be out on patrol. We'd come through villages. There were certain villages that I was, you know, thought that the people were pretty friendly and were for us. There were other villages that we really had our doubts about. When I was in the rear. From time to time, I'd be in the village that was outside of the Chu Lai base, you know, dealing with those little merchants, you know, buying little stuff, you know, having little conversations. But in terms of having an ongoing relationship, I mean, the person that I probably knew better than anyone else was the gal who was, you know, cleaning my hooch when I had a rear,
right.
a rear job.
Right.
You know, and she would show me pictures of her family, and I would show her pictures of mine, and remember trying to explain to her what snow was.
Really? How did you do it?
Oh, I don't know, like shaved ice, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to describe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because the pictures I had snow on the ground, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a very nice gal. So with all the gals were that were, you know, up working on the base, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I kind of felt sorry for them.
Did you?
Yep.
Did you tell them that? I mean, especially your hooch maid. Did you try to talk to them about how
well,
you felt?
Well, there were a number of accounts where girls in the rear would and you were warned against this, you know, that they wanted to have a relationship with you. They wanted to be your girlfriend. Because they wanted you to fall in love with them and marry them and take them back to the States.
How do you know this? Did they tell you this, or was this the deal? This was the rumor. This was what you were warned about.
Well, I don't remember if I was warned about it or not, but you know, I knew that it happened on a couple of occasions where guys, you know, fell in love with Vietnamese women,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Army made it very difficult for them if you got married, I think you were in trouble. If you tried to take this girl over to the States, I mean, the red tape was unbelievable. But there was no question in my mind that, you know, South Vietnamese people that worked in the rear were trying to find a way to get out of Vietnam and move to the States.
Did you ever have any incidents like that yourself?
No.
Okay.
No.
What do you think the Vietnamese thought of the Americans?
I think most of them thought we were very rich.
Mm-hmm.
And by their standards, we were. I think they probably thought we were arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we were. I'm talking about this is a reflection of when I had a rear job.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some of them thought us we were nice guys, and they thought some of us were idiots, which was also probably true.
Right, right.
You know,
I guess that's inevitable.
Yeah, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Did you get a sense that they understood why the United States was there and what you all were doing?
I only remember having a one little conversation, or I remember a snippet of a conversation in which my hooch mate made the comment somewhere along the lines that the Viet Cong were very bad people.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I mean, I don't remember having a lot of conversations about why, and I mean, it was just a given we were there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the civilians understood, like, the big picture, or are they more concerned, based on what you saw, especially in the field, with their day-to-day lives?
I think that they knew if we left, they were in deep shit. I really do.
And what is deep shit to you?
I mean that if we went away, that the NVA would be there in a couple weeks.
And what would happen?
What
do you think they thought would happen?
I think that they feared for their lives.
Okay.
I think that's why, you know, so many of them wanted to go to the States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's talk about going to the States. Let's talk about you coming home. You got shorter and shorter and shorter, and then you extended. Tell me your reasoning behind extending. You explain that.
Well, I had a cake job in the rear, mm-hmm. you know, that I didn't consider dangerous at all. I really didn't want to go back to Texas and ride tanks around and mm-hmm. play war games. And, you know, I would have thought that was a bunch of bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to get on with my life. So I saw an opportunity to start my life back as a civilian 5 months earlier than I would have if I'd have come back to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's why I extended an extra couple months to stay over there, so I could get out of the Army in April instead of September.
What were your plans after the Army? What did you have in mind? And when you were still in Vietnam, what did you think? You know, where did you see your life going?
Oh, there was no question, you know, and I said this to myself probably 100 times. If I get through this, if I ever get out of this fucking place,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to get my act together and I'm going to go back to school and I'm going to, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I was going to be more successful I was going to make a success out of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
did you not feel it was a success at the time?
No.
Based on your lack.
Well, I was not a good student. I was partying. I was horsing around. I would no direction. I was a pretty immature individual.
Is that Steve talking today, or did Steve back then, at age 22 or 3, see that?
Well, I saw myself as a much different person coming out of Vietnam than I did going in, or coming out of the Army than I did going into the Army.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me if, you know, was Vietnam a good experience, or was, they don't put it that way, but,
right.
In some ways, I don't want to ever have to do it again.
mm-hmm.
But it was, it really, I mean, there's nothing like getting shot at to, you know, kind of focus your life like a laser beam.
Is that what did it?
I think so, because it put so many things in perspective. When I came home. And I went back to school. My grades were so crummy when I came out of school that I went, you know, my folks had moved to Delaware and I applied to the University of Delaware. They wouldn't accept me as a full-time student.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had to go to school for a year as a part-time student. I think I took 6 credits a semester and proved that I could, you know, I had to have a B average for 12 credits in order to get accepted as a full-time student, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
But I was I think having the Vietnam experience helps make me a better person.
How did you become a better person? I mean, you just talked about it, but what do you mean by that? Is this what your Vietnam experience means to you?
Well, today? I think it gave me a new perspective. It gave me an appreciation for what I had. You know, and you know, you if you see a third world country and see how those people are trying to make a living and how many problems that they've got to overcome compared to being a citizen of the United States, I mean, it's just no comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get yourself in the middle of a few life and death situations,
mm-hmm.
you begin to appreciate life.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say I'm not fortunate to have that experience, but having that experience, brings a unique perspective.
Mm-hmm.
At least really helped me and get my act together.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just remember one of the things that I do remember very well is being in a foxhole and drizzling rain and muddy boots and wet and cold and thinking, if I ever get the hell out of here, man, I'm gonna make something out of my life.
Well, looking back right now today, in May 2005, did you do it?
Yeah, I think I'm living the American dream. I really am.
Really, you kept that promise to young Steve in that foxhole.
I think so. There have been some bumps along the road, but
mm-hmm.
I have a wonderful family and a great job and a nice house, and I make a nice living, and I didn't come from money or anything. I mean, there's lots of opportunity out there.
Right. Well, before we go there, can you describe coming home? I mean, how did that happen? This was April 71?
Yeah, this is April 71, and I was one of the lucky ones in that, I came out of the field and got a rear job, so I got to decompress a little bit from being in the field
yes.
to being in the rear and then coming home. And I knew a lot of guys that, who came out of the field and 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, they're home. And that's really a different transition to make than what I went through.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, I mean, hang on one sec.
Okay.
Coming home was wonderful, but it was different,
mm-hmm.
And at times difficult. But landing in Fort Lewis, I mean, doing that final wake up in Vietnam and signing out of where we flew out of, but getting on that plane and
was it July?
No, it wasn't July. I had to fly down to I think it's Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
I had to fly down to Cameron Bay and then go through all the forms and bells and whistles and get on a plane. And when you got all those guys on a plane and it was wheels up,
mm-hmm.
I mean the cheer that went up was unbelievable. And it was a long flight home, but I really don't remember very much of it. I think I slept most of the way.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember we had airplane problems and we had to stop in Japan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Jesus Christ,
Yeah.
I survive all this and I'm going to drown in the fucking ocean. Yeah. We had an engine go out or something, so we had to land in Japan, and we were in Tokyo for like 8 or 9 hours while they repaired the plane, and then we took off again and then we were off and running.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we landed in Seattle and spent a couple days in Fort Lewis, Washington,
mm-hmm.
and had a couple great steak dinners and more than a few beers. And I remember seeing the guys who were about to go over,
mm-hmm.
and they would look at you and want to come talk to you, and I just, you know, and I'm going, no.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything that you could say to those guys. Just, you know, pay attention and keep your head down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Steve, do you remember your feeling on the plane? I mean, you described the cheer, but when you left and you got out of Vietnamese airspace, how did you feel personally?
Oh, I was elated. I mean, I was just thrilled. I couldn't believe it. You know, I cheered, I'm sure, as hard, as loud as everybody else when those wheels were up,
mm-hmm.
Flying away from the coastline.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I think everybody was giving the flight attendants a hard time.
Yeah, I'm sure. I've heard that.
Yeah, right. But they were having a good time too. I think that they, my bet is they hated dropping guys off there and they loved bringing guys back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we were the guys that they got to bring back.
Yeah. Okay, so when you get into Seattle, nighttime or daytime?
Boy, I don't remember.
Okay, well, do you remember getting off and getting onto American soil? And,
well, you know what? It was morning when we got to. It was early morning when we got to Fort Lewis, so we must have got there like at break of day or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, having at 6 o'clock in the morning or something a steak dinner in the chow hall, in the mess hall at Fort Lewis there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, this is cool. Steak dinner and beer at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And whatever, you know.
But it worked for you.
But it worked just fine, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice changes about the United States? Anything?
Well, not at that point. I mean, because I was all Army on the plane ride, and I don't remember much of the airport in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was, you know, quickly on to Fort Lewis, so it was, you know, as much as anything, I think I loved the cool air.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just in Fort Lewis, I think, for 2 or 3 days, and send over to, battalion or some kind of headquarters, and sign a couple forms, and then there's a big book that you sign, and that's where you sign out of active duty. And you have to sign the statement that you're actually on active duty for the next 3 days,
mm-hmm.
so you're not allowed to go punch any officers or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then I caught a bus to there's a bus ride over to back to Seattle Airport, and I caught a United Airlines flight from
mm-hmm.
Seattle to Chicago, and then Chicago to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that I got on the plane and the stewardess woke me up after the plane landed,
mm-hmm.
and she goes, something to the effect, he goes, "You're unbelievable." And I said, "What?" And she goes, "That was the worst flight that I have ever been on." I guess we bounced all over the sky. People were getting sick everywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I slept through the whole thing.
Gosh. Is that a statement on the sleep deprivation over there, or you just were exhausted?
I think I was physically and mentally just drained.
Mm-hmm.
And then I caught the plane in Chicago to Philadelphia, and my folks lived down in Newark, Delaware, so then I was going to get a cab from. I told him, don't come pick me up. I just wanted to show up at home.
Mm-hmm.
And,
why?
I don't know. I just I didn't want all the hubbub in the airport, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in a I got in a cab on the at the airport to go over to 30th Street Station to catch a train to go down to Wilmington. And then my sister was going to pick me up at the train station in Wilmington, but the cab guy, I remember for some reason this sticks with me.
Mm-hmm.
I was in uniform and he wanted to know where I'd been, and I said I just came back from Vietnam, and I guess he had a nephew or somebody who was over there. So I got to 30th Street Station, and he said cab ride's on me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was very cool.
Well, that kind of falls in line with my next question is, and please continue to comment on that if you'd like, but what kind of reception did you receive in the United States? I mean, that's certainly a positive thing right there.
Yeah, that was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
And you did see that from, I think from guys who had either been in the military or who had sons or that were over there or nephews or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very strange. Nobody wanted to really talk about it. There was a lot of anti-war stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
Certain people would look at you like you were from Mars, and I think I mentioned.
What do you mean?
Well, there was stories going on about the atrocities that were going on over there, and I got home just as Senator Kerry was doing his shtick,
mm-hmm.
About how we were all barbarians and, people would look at you and go, well, they'd wonder.
Yeah.
And
So do you mind if I ask about that? You did think that Kerry's testimony before Congress did have a tangible effect upon your life right there in 1971?
I think he was a contributing, no question in my mind, he was a contributing force to how Vietnam soldiers who served in Vietnam got treated after Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just no question in my mind. I mean, you got a lieutenant who has supposedly served a tour of duty over in Vietnam, who's testifying to the fact that he's seen all these atrocities go on.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, the My Lai thing has come down.
Yes.
So that doesn't help. There are pictures like of that little girl who ended up with napalm on her. That doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
Helps. Stories like him then lead to movies like Platoon and what was the one with Marlon Brando?
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now, which were ridiculous, stupid movies.
Tell me why. Tell me about the Vietnam movies. I want to ask you about that later, but go ahead and comment on that if you'd like. Do you see them? Do you go? Do you try to avoid them?
The other one was I think the first one I saw was Deer Hunter,
mm-hmm.
which is another stupid movie.
Mm-hmm.
I would go see them, and I'd just come out and go. People would ask me, and I go, no, it's just. The helicopter scenes look good,
mm-hmm.
but that's about it. And I just realized what time it is here.
Yes. Do you want to go ahead and break, and we'll continue next week?
Yeah, I got a meeting downtown I got to get to.
This is Dr. Richard Verona continuing my oral history interview for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project with Mr. Steve Dant. Steve, why don't we continue? A couple of things that we wanted to talk about that you said specifically that you wanted to talk about since our last session was something you remembered about being in the rear, and then also something about being in the field. Why don't we start with what you remembered about being in the rear, and also let me say that it's May 25th, 2005, and it's about 8:37 a.m. Central Standard Time. Steve, go ahead.
There were two. What I remember is there were two different types of guys who were serving in the rear, at least from a grunt's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
There were the guys who had rear jobs who had been in the field, and there were guys who were rents who had rear jobs who had never been in the field. In my mind there was a distinct difference between. Those two types of soldiers who had jobs in the rear, what you tended to do when you got a rear job is you tended really to hang out more with the guys who had been in the field,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the guys who showed up in Vietnam and for whatever reason, whether they were. And this is, you know, nothing against those guys, they were lucky.
Right, sure.
Or they ended up getting the right MOS, as opposed to the guys who showed up in Vietnam and had a rear job and never went to the field.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference in serving in Vietnam between having but serving in Vietnam and having a job in the rear and having one in the field were, I mean, just 180 degrees different.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you had a rear job, and there was still an issue of you'd never got enough sleep because, well, in my case, I pulled a lot of guard duty at night, or if you were, you know, a lot of the guys that were out in the field that ended up at brigade or battalion headquarters were radio telephone operators, which meant that RTOs, which mm-hmm. meant they spent a lot of time in communicating with troops in the field, which meant that they pulled all-nighters also.
Mm-hmm.
There were other so the duty still was different than what you would have had in the States, but I mean the difference between the guys who served in the field and the guys who served in the rear, and I did both,
mm-hmm.
Were just very, very different.
Yeah. And you've commented a lot on those differences in the attitudes of both. What it sounds like is there's some kind of mutual respect that's there in general between the guys who were in the field and then went to the rear who were in the field.
Yeah.
And there is, I guess, maybe a lesser degree, correct me if I'm wrong, between those of you who were in the field and then compared or around those who were in the rear permanently.
The guys who were in the rear, I mean, just... I mean, they never really, and you wouldn't expect them to, just like nobody ever understands, and there's no way that you can fully explain what it's like to be in a combat unit out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but some of them, not all of them, I mean, just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And So there were rimps and there were rimps.
I hear you. That makes sense.
Right.
Are you saying that the real rimps who that was their MOS versus the rimps who were half field, half rimp?
Guys like me who ended up getting, who after spending a certain amount of time in a field,
sure.
and then lucked out and got a rear job somehow, I mean, I thought were a different class of rimp than the guys who had been there permanently.
And you're saying that your type of rimp, you, when you were back there, you guys garnered different respect from those who from those who were in the field.
Well, I think that the guys who had been in the field tended to hang out with guys who had been in the field as opposed to guys who were permanently back there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me about, you remembered something else about being in the field.
Well, I do remember when we had been in country. I had been in country for a while, and I don't know the exact date, but if I were to guess, I would say it was in summer sometime, when we were told that we were going to be we were told that there was a mission that was going into Laos,
mm-hmm.
We weren't going to be part of the troops that were going to go in, but we were going to be on standby reinforcement in case things did not go well. We would reinforce the troops that were in trouble or needed help or needed further support or whatever.
Right.
So. I remember going on one of the longest helicopter rides, I think, well, I'm sure it was, the longest helicopter ride that I'd ever taken. And we were flying, it seemed like for a long time, out west of Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
I may have been southwest of Chulai.
Mm-hmm.
Out near what probably was near. I mean, I didn't have a map with me at the time, but got us to within a pretty quick chopper ride to into Laos. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we were set up on a perimeter. I mean, basically waiting. And as I remember, we were there for a couple three days. Waiting to see what happened with the troops that actually had gone into Laos.
Mm-hmm.
We were all really really very nervous and very nervous and apprehensive, I guess, because we felt like if we were going to go in there, that means things were not going well.
Right.
And meant we were going to go in hot.
Right.
Which didn't make anybody happy. So after a couple of 3 days of just hanging around, we ended up not going in, and we ended up getting back on choppers, and I don't remember where we went from there, but I remember everybody was very relieved that we weren't going to have to support the troops that went in there, and I guess I do remember that I guess we found a whole bunch of, you know, caches of weapons and supplies, and you know, bombed a bunch of bunkers, and I remember reports at the time also that they're reading some reports back from the States, and I don't remember if it was Stars and Stripes or Hanging Armed Forces Radio about arguments about what are we doing going into Laos, and there was some denial that we were there.
Right.
from some politician.
Massive denial.
Right, massive denial. Yeah. I remember thinking, well, shit, if we weren't, mm-hmm. who were those guys, you know?
Right. Did you guys actively discuss this kind of stuff? Like, my God, why are we going into Laos? Or what's going on in Laos? We've heard this, but was this part of your discussion?
Well, we knew why. We knew why we were going into Laos, and there was no doubt in everybody's mind where the supplies were coming, and were coming down those trails that were mm-hmm. out of North Vietnam through Laos, and you know, farther south of us was Cambodia,
mm-hmm.
And that's how the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese were being resupplied. So,
right,
in some ways. From a you know, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Right. Well, what do you think about that, looking back at it? What do you think about America being in Laos? Was that something that, does it make sense to you? I mean, if it was a no-brainer then, what do you think about it now?
I think it made sense. I mean, you know, we were at war with those guys.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the Viet Cong and NVA were getting their supplies. I mean, mm-hmm. anything we could do to hurt that supply line, to cut them off, made it more difficult for them to launch any kind of, you know, ambush or whatever against us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I guess, we understood why, you know, that, people in the States would, some of them would not be happy about this because obviously they would see it as an escalation of the war.
Right.
But if you're on the ground, that's how the Viet Cong or NVA are getting resupplied. I mean, let's figure out a way to cut that off.
Right. Right. Okay. What else?
I mean, somewhat goes back to what I was saying before that, that we did, I guess it's part of, and although I probably didn't think about it at the time, is the tactics of what we were doing, sometimes didn't make sense. But this one didn't necessarily not make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that pretty much, there's just a lot of aspects to this war that you just kind of go around in circles on.
Right. Do I hear you saying that, at some point the United States needed to get into Cambodia and Laos and cut the Ho Chi Minh Trail and attack the sanctuaries? That, 1970, 71 was too late? Or it was late and
well,
that
I
was
go
not
back
good?
To what I think I said earlier. Either get in to win this thing or get the hell out.
Right.
Don't be screwing around.
Mm-hmm.
just trying to hold on to positions or almost fight it on the enemy's terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do you think the United States didn't do that? What do you think was going on? Was it the...
Well, I can answer that now. I couldn't have answered it later
because,
right. I've done some reading since then.
Right.
And if you go back and read what Johnson and McNamara and then later Nixon were doing, especially Johnson and McNamara, mm-hmm. they were trying to, as much as anything... fight hard enough to hold the enemy at bay, but not so hard that they thought there was some danger about bringing in China and into the war effort. And
mm-hmm.
I think that they were really looking for some way to establish South Vietnam as a separate country and not worrying about defeating North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you're also, lying to the people about how many troops you're planning on sending there, you're somewhat lying to yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steve, let's go back to when you came home and what was going on. We had discussed a little bit of that. You talked about John Kerry and his testimony to Congress and what you thought that was doing to kind of the mindset and morale of the country. But before we get there, I want to ask you about your personal transition to civilian life and when you came home. What was that like?
Well, I'm not sure I know quite how to answer that. I think I told you there were some good parts to it and there were some bad parts to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the good part to it was a guy in Philadelphia, a cab driver, who gave me a free ride from
yes.
from the airport over to 30th Street Station.
Yes.
But you got home to at least family was were very happy to see you. I mean, they were, I think they'd been sitting on pins and needles since I left and were glad that I was home.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're close friends. But it was strange in that there were a lot of things that I didn't want to talk about, and at the same time there were your friends and family didn't really want to talk about it either.
Right.
And so you were in many respects you were kind of out there in limbo. The Cali situation, with the massacre in My Lai and all of that was that had happened,
mm-hmm.
didn't help. What really didn't help is that instead of My Lai being considered an exception, which I really think it was. I'm not here to say that all American troops were goody two shoes and nice guys. We were grunts, and we had to be tough and sometimes be tough with the Vietnamese people, but. I don't know of another incident that even comes close to what happened in My Lai.
Right.
And yet you had a naval officer testifying in front of Congress that basically that was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
That's in my mind, as I look back at this now, set up a 10 or 20 year period,
mm-hmm.
where people, considered that the norm,
mm-hmm.
and considered Vietnam soldiers or Vietnam veterans to be people that needed to be watched very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
and I don't think that was fair. And I don't think it was deserving. I had some incidents when I came home where you learn when you're in combat to wake up in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody shakes your shoulder, or somebody kicks your boot or something. I mean, one of the things that you learn to do, man, is to come instantly awake, and try to become very aware of where you are and what the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
Because you may have, you may be getting waken up by incoming, or somebody's heard some, rattle of a bush or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, for a long time, you wait. I would wake up with a start.
Mm-hmm.
My family had to be careful about how they woke me up in the morning.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What was that like? What do you mean? Were they really, literally had to be very careful?
Well, I had one incident where my mom made the mistake of coming over and she must have shook me on the shoulder or something, and I came up with a start and out of bed, and I knocked her down.
Oh, yeah?
And, she kind of got upset by that, and I had to tell her, look, yell at me from across the room,
yeah.
Throw something at me, but You know, it's just, and I don't remember exactly what I told her, but I told her just, you know, I tend to have to wake up in a hurry and I get over this, but don't do that again.
Yeah.
So, you know, those kinds of things worry parents and loved ones and that kind of thing. And you slowly, after a while, get over that kind of stuff.
How much did you talk to your parents about what you had been through?
Not much. Like I said, it's just, you know, everybody was very glad you were home. You know, I guess there was a sense of, we're sorry you had to go through this. You know, it was a very strange time, and I, because of all the things that were happening politically at home, as well as what was being said about Vietnam soldiers, and you know, so it was like everybody wanted to get over this. And get this behind us.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot of conversations about what had happened over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in my own case, I mean, that's only, you know, I've talked to my wife about this a lot, off and on, through, you know, 30 years of knowing her. And you know, it's all sprinkled out over time.
Mm-hmm.
But she's probably one of the only ones that I've had these conversations with up until recently.
Mm-hmm. What made you change and talk about it more recently?
I think I said early on that, you know, 9/11 was like a flashpoint to me.
Yeah.
I took it very personally. Somebody would attack our country, and you know, I thought right from the get-go, we needed to take the offense, because to play defense would be unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever been in a war zone, the last thing you want is to be in another war zone, or to have your family have to deal with a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
That's just unacceptable. You got to take it to the people who are attempting to take it to you, or. I mean, there's just no other way to do it, or you will suffer the consequences,
mm-hmm.
and the consequences are unacceptable. I also took not to the degree that I took 9/11, but the Kuwait War was a very personal thing. For me as well. I mean, it was the first time that since the Vietnam War that American troops were going to go back and on a very large what's the word I'm searching for? On a very large basis, go back into a combat situation.
Yeah.
And I really felt for the guys who were and I don't remember the exact day, but the day that Schwarzkopf, you know, basically said, "Let's go."
Mm-hmm.
The mission was on. I mean, I just felt for those guys who were getting into helicopters and on tanks and were,
mm-hmm.
you know, going into harm's way.
Mhm. To bring back memories for you?
Brought a lot of memories back.
Yeah.
But it was also, I mean, it was a gratifying time as well, because I remember I was in Pittsburgh the day that Schwarzkopf, the troops were launched, and Pittsburgh on that day had decided that. That at some time, and I don't remember, and I remember walking down the street. I'd just come out of a business meeting. And they decided that they were going to ring all the church bells at some designated time. And I was walking down the street, and I'm going, "Holy shit, this is wonderful!
Mm-hmm.
It's nice that we could support our troops."
Yeah. What about today, when you see what's happening in the Middle East and Central Asia, troops coming back? What are your feelings about that?
Well, we had Colorado Springs is the home of Fort Carson, which has a lot of troops in and out of Iraq all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And last summer, when I think 20,000 troops came home, the town put on a big parade.
Right.
And they had, this is a town, this is a city of about, 450,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
They had 100,000 people.
Wow.
Lining the streets, which was very cool.
Were you there?
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have missed that for the world.
Did you see yourself in those young men and women who were in the parade?
No, not really. I just wanted to make sure that those guys, men and women, as the case would be here, that they got the support that they deserved, or got the thank you that they really deserved.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just didn't want them to come home and not be welcomed home like Vietnam veterans weren't welcomed home.
You've kind of touched on this, but let me ask this straight up. Why was the American public indifferent to you guys? And there are a lot of reasons. You've already talked a lot about different things, but if you could answer that in a concise way, because that question constantly comes up with students who study the war today, with the public, with the media. I don't know if anybody really understands it from the veteran's point of view and why that happened.
Well, I know you want me to be concise about that.
Well, again. I didn't mean it that way. I meant like
I think that's a kind of a multiple answer to that.
Yes.
By the time 70-71 came along, there was a lot of anti-war fervent and or feelings in the country.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. There was
you include Kerry in that, basically, that kind of anti-war America's doing wrong.
No, Kerry is separate from that. There was, I think, also there was an embarrassment about the war, because America felt as if parts of America felt like we were losing, and this was the first war that America was going to lose, you know, and we were the soldiers who were going to lose that war. So that was part of it. And I don't think anybody would ever admit to that, but I think it was an underlying feeling that you know, the Vietnam soldiers weren't as good as other soldiers in past wars, and then you get to people like Kerry who contributed to that directly. You know, I almost puked when he got up and said, "I'm reporting for duty," when he was nominated for to be the Democratic candidate for president. Guys, either stupid or ballsy or one or the other. The guy who defamed us worse than anybody else coming home was now going to use his Vietnam record as a foundation to become president of the United States.
What did you think of the rest of the VAW members, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War?
I really didn't understand where those guys were coming from. I thought that they were. It was one of the reasons that. I come to find out a lot of people felt the same way. I'm going, who are these guys? What are they talking about? You know, I didn't know anybody like this when I was in Vietnam. I didn't hang around people that were, I didn't know Vietnam veterans like this when I was either at home or when I was going back to University of Delaware or when I went into a career. Vietnam veterans were, you know, kind of like me. Guys who either got drafted or enlisted and did their duty and came home and tried to get back into the American way of life. And you know it was almost a light bulb went off when it was a movie with Tom Cruise, where the guy ends up in a wheelchair, ends up being very bitter. Born on the 4th of July.
Yes.
It turns out the guy was a fraud.
Yeah.
You know. You know, that...
You're talking about Ron Kovic?
Yeah. I think that's the guy I'm talking about.
Yeah, he was the central character of that.
Right. And, you know, it turns out he didn't have nearly the experiences that he was, you know, claiming to have. And so, it was like Kerry and the people like him and that group helped perpetuate a lot of myths about what happened in Vietnam and the Vietnam soldiers that it took us almost 20 years to get over and to get past, and for people to begin to say, you know what, the things that Kerry and his folks were talking about weren't true. And it's another reason a lot of people didn't want to talk about what was going on, because they thought somehow you might have been part of that.
Right. Did it affect you being in the war when you came back? Did it affect you, like getting jobs or and that kind of thing?
No, at least I never saw that. You know, I went back to college, you know, and that was in some ways, you know, strange, because you know every university had its anti-war groups and had some kinds of demonstrations going on, although most of that was over by the time I was back being a full-time student. I was a different student because I was a little older, you know, because, you know, you go back, and I didn't really start back to school until I was 22, and I was, you know, graduated when I was 25.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the student body is, you know, 18, 19, 20-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't doing the normal things that, you know, undergraduates do in college.
Yeah.
I was working in a men's clothing store, and there were a couple guys there who were, you know, juniors and seniors, and they were 20, 21 years old, and they said, well, we want you to, you know, why don't you come join our fraternity? It was one of the nicer houses on campus, and I said, well, sounds like you guys have a lot of fun, and blah, 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 and he goes, the only thing you have to do is you have to go through the, you know, initiation. Well, what's the initiation going to be like? And I said, I thought, they try that shit on me, somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it was bullshit that I wasn't going to go through.
Yeah.
What
was it like being in college right after the war? I mean, you went back, you came back in 71, and how soon were you back in school?
Well, I got back in April of 71, and I started back part-time school in that fall.
Wow.
I was working, just about working full-time in a men's clothing store. I'd done some of that when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And taking classes at night. And then after a year, then I started going full-time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just as I was starting back as a full-time student, moving into a new apartment, that I met my...
I'm sorry, Steve, you cut out. Say that again. You met your...
Met my wife.
Okay.
And she was... She was younger than I am. She was a couple years ahead of me. She was starting her senior year, and I was just, you know, halfway through my sophomore or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a big help in getting me past a lot of these issues as well.
Mm-hmm. How so? What did she do for you then?
She's a good listener.
She was interested in what you had been through.
Yep.
Was she one of the first ones to really take interest?
Yeah, I think
sincerely?
So. I mean, there were other people who took an interest, but it was almost you know, kind of like looking at somebody from a sideshow at the circus. Interest. You know,
that's how you saw yourself.
That's how a lot of people, you know, they wanted to know what was going on, but they only, you know, they didn't really. Where she had some, I think, heartfelt interest in, part of it was, I think, probably knowing who I was, but, it took a personal interest.
Mm-hmm. Obviously that touched you, that meant something to
you. Yep. No question.
Yeah. Well, how much did you follow what was happening in Southeast Asia? You know, when you came back and you were in school, there's still plenty of stuff happening there.
Oh, I was still following it a lot. You know, I thought we should, you know, I was never one of the Vietnam veterans against the war marchers. I thought that those guys were all weird. but at the same time, I believed, you know, I felt like even if we can't win this thing, then let's get the hell out. And I also felt like, you know, we ought to be supporting the South Vietnamese as much as we could. And and try to help them win the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I also knew in the back of my mind that if we left, they were toast.
Yeah. Yeah, you had already talked about that.
Right.
What did you think that we needed to do, or what would you have liked to have seen us do in the United States? You know, after you left, early 70s?
Well, I don't know what else you could have done than what we did, and that was to try to negotiate our way out, mm-hmm. Because it was too late to go back and try to win this thing the right way, And I read someplace recently that, and I don't remember where it was, some general was quoted that we lost this war the wrong way. And his point was, and I guess I agree with this, is that we never should have gotten past the advisory role of in terms of involvement in this war. And this is hindsight, and speaking 2020, 2020 hindsight,
Sure.
Because it was the South Vietnamese people who were ultimately going to have to be responsible for winning or losing this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't willing to fight to the and get their act together, both politically and militarily,
mm-hmm.
then we'd probably still be there.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were going to lose this thing, his point was, we should have lost it from an advisory capacity as opposed to committing hundreds of thousands of troops into this campaign. Because once we did that, then the Vietnamese kind of went, okay, good, you guys can do this for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I guess I didn't realize it at the time, but that's kind of the way I felt, was that, again, if we aren't in there to win this thing, and I never felt like we were, then let's get the hell out. Let's mm-hmm. try to find an honorable way to get the hell out of this thing.
Yeah. What about you commented on Vietnamization and kind of how you did not think the South Vietnamese could pick up the ball and run with it. What about, when we kind of started withdrawing and got out permanently in 73 and then Paris peace is signed and Kissinger announces peace with honor. Did you see it that way? Or what were your thoughts then?
No, I don't think anybody thought that we were going to have peace with honor. I think we were kidding ourselves.
Yeah.
I think we lost the war. The North Vietnamese won.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, there is some honor in being a good soldier, but there's no honor in defeat.
What did you think about Nixon and that administration and what happened?
I thought Nixon was an asshole.
Yeah.
I thought his, I looked at him as kind of carrying on what Johnson was already doing. I think that he, in looking back, Nixon was probably a little more honest about it than Johnson was in carrying out the war. But, at the time, I didn't, think that, as a troop in the field or, when I got home that, that he was a very honorable guy, that he was a very good president.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he, and then Watergate, just confirmed a lot of things about, he had some personality traits that were that did not lend themselves very well to being a good leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about Johnson? Can you make some comments on him?
Well, again, some things I did not know at the time, but it's pretty obvious now why he decided, not to run for re-election for president,
mm-hmm.
because it was going to come out that he had misled the American people about our involvement in the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
and the quagmire that he had gotten us into.
Mm-hmm.
He did. There's no question that he did a lot of great things for civil rights in this country.
Mm-hmm.
But in my mind, there's no question that he lied up one side and down the other about what his plans were, you know, and in fact, actually, what he was doing with
mm-hmm.
regard to attempting to step by step escalate the war in Vietnam.
Right.
And he and McNamara just lied their asses off.
Why do you think they're doing that? Just to make them not look so bad, or because they really believe that? You know, that this was, okay, this is a bit of a lie, but you know, this is actually really going to happen for the United States, or this is happening for the United States. Maybe not that, you know, one thing or one incident in, you know, Gulf of Tonkin or whatever it is that's coming out. Do you think Johnson was genuine? You know, you said Nixon kind of, no, he was not.
Well, I think Johnson, you know, as you know, looking back on it now, you know, I think Johnson in some ways almost, he was so absorbed with what was going on domestically with his Great Society plan that, you know, he didn't have his eye on the ball as to what was going on with regard to Vietnam. And that's why I keep bringing up McNamara's name,
mm-hmm.
because there was the guy who was leading Johnson along as to, you know, how we should, how we can slowly escalate this thing and make the enemy come to the table, and we're going to scare the shit out of these guys, and they'll see it our way. Well, that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what is happening in
mm-hmm.
in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. An underestimation, perhaps, of the enemy?
Absolutely. I mean, they didn't understand that in some respects they were getting into the middle of a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we got into the middle of.
Yeah, yeah. What about John Kennedy? What can you say about him?
I like a lot of what John Kennedy was saying at the time. I don't think he was alive long enough to form an opinion about what he was going to do or not do in Vietnam. He had advisors on the ground as far as I remember, but at the point where Kennedy died, we were still in an advisory capacity
mm-hmm.
with South Vietnamese army and whoever was in charge of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a problem that Kennedy ran into, it was probably determining which corrupt individual was going to be the president or premier or the leader of South Vietnam. I've forgotten the title.
No, didn't
you? Yeah. Well, yes, but I mean, you know, we were trying to determine which corrupt individual was the better one to lead Vietnam.
Right. You look. You had people called big men, and then you had General Nguyen Khan.
Right.
Yeah, and then. Two.
And then, wasn't it Lin Cao Ki or something like that?
Ki, yeah, and two were the ones they kind of settled on for the remainder
right.
of the thing.
But, you know, I just, Kennedy wasn't around long enough for to really kind of, I mean, he wasn't, but you would hope that he would have seen things a little differently or more clearly than Johnson in terms of what we would get into in terms of escalating this war.
Mm-hmm.
Although McNamara was his guy too, so
mm-hmm.
maybe it would have gone the same way.
So what did you think, or how did you feel in April 1975 when Saigon fell and the country fell?
I guess I was very sad. I was not surprised. It was just a gloomy day. I still have, I think, one or two old Newsweek magazines of about that time,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I kept all these years of the troops coming home and
mm-hmm.
Pull out dates. And I don't remember what's on the front cover. I remember it's a big helmet on the front cover. I don't remember what it says, though. I should go dig that out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was following it. I guess I was resigned to what was going to happen. I mean, before Saigon fell, I knew that was going to happen. I knew it was going to be a mess.
Yeah. When you left country, you knew.
Yeah.
Eventually.
Yep.
Do you think, how does that reflect upon you personally? Do you think it, did you feel it personally, or was it more this is the United States?
I guess some of both.
Yeah.
As I look back on it now, I guess I still think it was a personal loss to have put that much effort and time and have so many people get hurt and killed, you know, and then to, you know, the South Vietnamese have not done better under the North Vietnamese conquerors. I mean, it's, you know, and how many people, you know, I've heard estimates of hundreds of thousands of people I know went into those re-education camps
mm-hmm.
And never came out. Look at how many refugees, you know, went, you know, on boats trying to escape or went over to Thailand or Laos or Cambodia and lived in camps because, you know, they'd rather take their chances with Khmer Rouge than with the North Vietnamese. What does that say?
Yeah.
This was a regime that was going to take over, and they were going to kick ass and take names,
mm-hmm.
and they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was very much a huge loss of life, and in a lot of respects, that's embarrassing. You know, it's embarrassing when I go back to Kerry again, but if we get out, a few thousand people will get killed. Well, you obviously don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you, looking back, Steve, what do you think about your service in Vietnam? Personally, taking a look at the, you know, significance for you.
Well, you know, I think I said that I'm not sure I'd want to do it again, but I'm glad I had the experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm proud of the service that I had in Vietnam. I wasn't a great soldier, but I think I was a pretty good soldier, and you know I I don't think anybody can fault, you know, and obviously this is somewhat self-serving, but the job that the grunts did on the job and on the ground in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always wondered about that for years and years and years after you hear all these stories and about all these so-called atrocities and what have you, but.
Mm-hmm.
You come to realize again those were the exception to the rules, to the rule, and you know, most of the guys that I met, you know, were kind of ordinary, you know, come from middle America families who went over and thought they were doing their duty.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would change about your experience if you could?
God, you know, that's a what if question.
Yeah, sure it is.
You know, because you know, well, we never should have gotten ourselves into the situation that we got ourselves into. You know, so you know, I guess, you know, the question that goes by, well, if you had to, the question I get asked, if you had it to do all over again,
mm-hmm.
you know, would you have gone to Canada?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the answer is, it's a moot point.
It's what we call in the historian field counterfactual history.
Yeah, right, because of course, in any place that you're in your life, if you could go back and redo something all over again, you might. But you know, then the circumstances aren't the same,
mm-hmm.
because then you know something different than what you knew then.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if I could go back and change something, I'd go back and try to have a conversation with President Johnson and Secretary of Defense Mr. McNamara.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
Be honest with yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that they were.
What if they'd said, well, Steve, you just don't understand it up here at this level.
Well, then you go back to the hindsight question, you know, and then it becomes another moot point.
Yeah, good answer. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned about Steve Dant in Vietnam?
I guess that that I was that I shouldn't waste my life. That there were, you know, that. That I needed to get my act together.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that?
That I wasn't. I guess I wasn't running my life very well prior to that.
Right. You mentioned that. Do you think that you have done that? You think you succeeded?
Oh yeah. You know, Vietnam woke me up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I became a. You know, I don't want to say a better person, but a more focused person,
mm-hmm.
A better, you know, it matured me. It got me to be more goal-oriented,
mm-hmm.
and make me realize that I could, you know, if you go through a stint in a field, you realize. A lot of the other things that you were kind of blowing off, or that's not right. You know, it makes other things seem a lot less difficult. You know,
mm-hmm. What do you think about Vietnam today?
Well, it's I have mixed emotions about us reestablishing relationships with Vietnam.
Tell me about that. Why?
Well, the the resentful side of me says, "Don't give those bastards anything."
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's realistic.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of me says, get over it.
Mm-hmm.
That's foolish. That we don't try to reconcile our differences. So I'll get over it.
Yeah. Have you ever wanted to go back, or do you plan to?
No. I've talked to some other guys who either have been or are planning to go back, but I have one friend who kind of said to me, why don't we think about going back together? And I go, nah, Dave, I don't know. I really don't think I want to go do that.
Mm-hmm.
I may change my mind, but right now I don't think so.
Why not?
I just don't want to. I don't want to go back and relive some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That close up.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I may change my mind, but I don't think so.
Okay. Well, do you think Vietnam is still with the United States today, or have we been able to put it behind us?
Oh, I think it's with us all the time.
How so?
I think it's with us somewhat of how we're dealing with Iraq and Iran. I think particularly, and hell, I'm in the business. I think that there is still a distrust of American military and presidential power.
Mm-hmm.
I think it shows through in how the war gets reported.
Mm-hmm.
I look at some press reports, coming out of Iraq, and I ask myself of that reporter, whose side are you on? And the answer comes back, well, we're trying to be neutral. Well, bullshit,
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, our reporters weren't neutral. I mean, they tried to get to the facts, but they were Americans first.
Mm-hmm.
I think that comes from that attitude of distrust, comes from the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to Johnson, and it goes back to McNamara, and it goes back to Nixon, and those guys, goes back to when I'm sitting out there and acting as reinforcing, standing by as reinforcing troops that for guys who are going into to Laos. And there was denial of what we were doing by the president back in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the military and the president have to protect the troops at some point, with regard to giving away the plans. I mean, the surprise is an element you want, but you have to level with the American people and over the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Johnson did and what Nixon did created a distrust, and what the military did created a distrust that lives on today, and it's something that the press needs to get over.
Well, you're in the media, right?
Yes.
So, from your standpoint, from looking, I guess, from the inside out, do you think that the press needs to get over that, move forward? What needs to be done differently?
I think that you have to come from this from a it's the word bias because it's overused these days.
I'm sorry, you cut out again. You said you hate to use the word bias,
but it's overused.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's trying to beat Ben. But there's you have to get over Vietnam. I think you have to come up from a perspective of let's trust what the military is telling us. Let's trust what the president is telling us. Let's trust what the Secretary of Defense is telling us until we find out that they're not telling us the truth.
So give them the benefit of the doubt first.
Right. And we're not doing that as a press corps. What we're doing is we're coming from the position of we don't trust you, and until you know, you go through all of these exercises, that then maybe we'll allow you to win back some credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's detrimental to, number one, the troops in the field.
Right.
You know, we're almost right back to, and I don't care what anybody says. If you call the president a liar, if you call the Secretary of Defense a liar, if you question their ethics, you got troops in the field. Those guys and those women hear that. And the last thing that they want to the last thing you want them to start thinking is that their leaders have no credibility.
Mm-hmm.
It does hurt the troops in the field. That's why you asked the question 5 or 10 minutes ago. Vietnam's still thought about. I think it's thought about in a whole lot of different areas,
mm-hmm.
and I certainly see it in the press corps.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's one of the lessons that the media needs to take, or the country needs to take forward? Is don't forget that let's move fast this, and in the media specifically.
I think the media needs to get over Vietnam. You know, so many young reporters, reporters today cut their teeth on Woodward and Bernstein,
mm-hmm.
With regard to All the President's Men,
mm-hmm.
and the finding out that the Nixon presidency was corrupt. You know, those are their heroes. So it's a gotcha game.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, I mean it's a reporter's duty, it's the press's duty to hold the government accountable. To find out what's going on behind the scenes. I'm not saying they should roll over for any government But
I'm sorry, cut out again. Any government?
No, I said they shouldn't roll over for any government or military group.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there should be some respect for those institutions, and I think that there, in some ways, is a lack of respect. And I think that's a carryover from Johnson and Nixon, and we're still living with those sins.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Well, on that note, tell me, we'd already talked a little bit about this, but tell me about how Hollywood has portrayed Vietnam and your thoughts on that.
Well, some of the same carryover. I mean, I guess you can tell I'm not a fan of Senator Kerry, but his testimony, gives life to, My Lai was there were lots of My Lais, there were lots of soldiers like Callie, and so, there you go. You get Hollywood right behind that. I mean, the portrayals of most American Vietnam veterans in the years following the war were, look at the movies and look at how they're portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Either a bunch of nutcases or people with no consciences, ethics. Not to say there weren't some terrible things that happened in war. There are always terrible things that happen in war. But the way the Vietnam veteran got portrayed as opposed to any other war, even the Rambo stuff.
Right.
you go from portraying the American soldier as a nutcase and barbaric, as Kerry would say,
mm-hmm.
to then Rambo, who's a guy who's kind of out of it, but you feel sorry for him.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're starting to feel sorry for the American soldier.
Mm-hmm.
There have probably only been a couple of movies that have somewhat captured what happened in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Can you give me examples?
Well, probably the first half of
Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal Jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Was pretty true depiction of basic training.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought once they got to the war part, I thought it was, sophomoric.
Mm-hmm.
There were parts of We Were Soldiers that I could kind of see. Parts of Hamburger Hill.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, the rest of them were they had good helicopter scenes.
So that was pretty true to form.
True to form, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that movies like Apocalypse Now and maybe Platoon, parts of Platoon, did that hurt the American Vietnam veteran?
I think so. Again, you look at those movies and you go, and that's why people were reluctant to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really what it was like? Is that what you're like?
Mm-hmm.
Or you hear some, there was more made in the press of, and there always is. The press is going to go, if it's part of that. If it leads, it bleeds. If it bleeds, it leads.
Mm-hmm.
Some Vietnam veteran who goes off the goes off the reservation and kills somebody or his family or whatever, and, you know, that gets a lot of headlines.
Right.
What doesn't get a lot of headlines are the guys, you know, came out, went back to school or went back to work or, you know, living a, you know, living an American life.
Mm-hmm. You think that's the majority of Vietnam veterans?
No question in my mind.
Yeah. What about books on Vietnam? I'm sorry, go ahead, Steve.
The overwhelming majority.
What about books on Vietnam? You said you've done some reading. Anything come to mind that struck you as being really valid, a worthwhile read? I hate to put you on the spot for titles. You don't need to do that, but you can make general comments to people.
There was one I read a while ago, and most of it focused on can't remember the name of it. Well, I've read Burkitt's book.
Mm-hmm.
On
Stolen Valor.
Stolen Valor.
Mm-hmm.
I read that a while ago. The most recent one I read was which one was it?
Was it David Marinus? They walked into someone?
No, McMaster.
Yeah, H.R. McMaster.
Dereliction of Duty.
Yes.
I thought that was a great read.
Okay. Well, in the same vein, what would you tell young people, Steve, about the Vietnam War? If you walked into a high school classroom or a college classroom, you could say whatever you wanted to. What would you tell them?
Boy, I don't know how to say that without going back, you know, 3 hours worth. But
well,
you know, I guess you know, don't believe everything you read or hear. There's probably half of what you read or hear isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
I think Americans' hearts were basically in the right place when we started down this road. You know, I think we had some poor leadership along the way. There are a lot of great stories that came out of Vietnam. It wasn't all negative.
Mm-hmm.
And we all need to get over it. That's all obviously not easy.
Mm-hmm.
Easier said than done. But I don't mean forget about it when I say that. I mean that we need to some of what I was saying before. We need to learn from our experience, but don't be caught in the trap of thinking that just because we made a mistake that we should not be pushing forward as into our development as a country. You know, a lot of people make mistakes in business or in life or whatever it is, and they want to crawl in a hole because they're afraid of making another mistake. You know, and I think that in some respects, the United States has did that for a while, but you know, we're a great country, and our heart's in the right place, and the worst thing we can do is to crawl in a hole and go, oh, woe is me. We owe ourselves more than that, and we owe, you know, the rest of the world more than that.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to the wall in Washington?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that experience or experiences?
Well, it was after 9/11. It was after I hooked up with a bunch of guys who I'd known in Vietnam. It was the first AmeriCal reunion that I went to. It was the, I've forgotten what year, anniversary of the wall, so, you know, it was like a big anniversary. So there were tons of people there.
Mm-hmm.
It was on Veterans Day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess I was like everybody else. I was sad, and, you know, I felt like well, to a certain extent, you know, what a waste.
Mm-hmm.
Found a couple guys who I knew on the wall. Cried like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It took me a long time to get there. I'd said for years and years and years, and people go on the wall. Nope, not going.
why would you say that?
Why would I want to go there? Mm-hmm. Well, because I knew it would be an emotional experience, you know. And as I said, you know, I spent years trying to put this all behind me, and that was just going to bring it back.
So when you were there, did it?
Oh, sure. I mean, like I said to, you know, a couple of guys in my unit, you know, it's funny. You spend 30 years or whatever trying to put all this stuff behind you, and then something happens, and all of a sudden you're sitting around in one of these reunions and you're showing pictures to each other and you're trying to remember.
Trying to remember.
Trying to remember.
Right.
All these things that, you know, where was this and what day was this and do you remember that? And, you know, it's just 180 degrees. Thank you, Osama bin Laden.
And you say that sarcastically,
yeah.
Obviously.
Well, it's 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the remembrance that you've gone through recently, and it seems to me, after talking to you for so long, that it's been a cathartic thing for you. It's been a positive thing for you. I mean, obviously with bittersweet memories in some cases, but am I wrong?
Yeah, somewhat. There's no question about that. You know, the one thing that the one question I always got asked of me along the way, you know, that a lot of times, you know, is that, you know, if you had to do it all over again, question.
Right.
You know, and my answer has always been, do I want to do it all over again? No. But am I glad I went through it? Am I glad I did this?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily, but on the other hand, I am glad I had the experience. It changed me as an individual, and there's a greater appreciation of, I guess, what you have.
Mm-hmm.
that's kind of very hard to explain. It's, you know, you know, kind of almost silly, you know. You know, like sometimes the marathon runners or people who do a lot of exercising, you know, and I've done a lot of running in my life. Why do you do this? Well, it feels so good when I stop.
That's true. As a former marathoner, I absolutely agree with you.
Well, I've never run a marathon, but I've run a lot of 10 and 15 Ks.
Mm-hmm.
So, did I answer your question?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Steve, is there anything else that you feel like we need to talk about or cover?
I can't think of anything at this point.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and end the oral history interview with Steve Dant for the Vietnam Archive Oral History Project. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.